It's Wednesday, May 27th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams reporting from Washington. Coming up, Human Rights Watch accuses officials in four Southeast Asian countries of being involved in the brutal treatment of migrants.
It's not an area where people can just come and go as they please. And obviously there must have been officials who knew about this on both the Thai and the Malaysian side.
The U.S. state of Texas battles severe floods, and U.S. veterans grieve for their fallen friends. It's all ahead. As Malaysian authorities clear dozens of grave sites and suspected people smuggling camps, Human Rights Watch accused government officials in four Southeast Asian countries, Myanmar, Bangladesh, Thailand, and Malaysia, of being complicit in the brutal treatment of migrants from Bangladesh and Myanmar, also known as Burma. Malaysian police say nearly 140 grave sites were discovered near 28 abandoned camps near the Thai border and have begun the grim task of exhuming bodies. Mass graves were also discovered this month in Thailand. Human Rights Watch says it interviewed Rohingya and other survivors who were held in camps in both countries until they could pay a ransom. They described horrific treatment at the hands of unscrupulous smugglers and traffickers in Myanmar and abuse and neglect aboard overcrowded and unsanitary boats in search of a better life. They were abandoned after Thailand launched a crackdown on transit camps May 1st. VOA's Victor Beatty spoke with Human Rights Watch Deputy Asia Director Phil Robertson about the allegation of official complicity in northern Malaysia.
That area is a security area. It's not an area where people can just come and go as they please. And obviously there must have been officials who knew about this on both the Thai and the Malaysian side. What we've seen in Thailand so far is the arrest of local political officials, people at the sub-district and the village level. We've also seen police under suspicion, both at the district level and up to the provincial level. We think that there's probably higher-level links involved as well. We also note that the military so far, which was very present in those areas, has not come under suspicion, which is a bit worrying to us because we think that there should be accountability for all people involved, regardless of what service they are in or what their rank is. On the Malaysia side, the government has cast the light on forestry officials, reflecting that this is a forested area. But I would be surprised if they're not only forestry officials involved, but also I think that they're probably police and immigration and other people who may have been involved as well. And I think that the Malaysian government, like the Thai government, needs to cast a wider net if they're really going to get to the bottom of official complicity in, with these trafficking rackets.
Human Rights Watch estimates between 3,000 and 4,000 people may still be aboard these ships adrift at sea, some of them for months. You have some firsthand accounts after interviewing some of these people.
Yes. Well, we spoke to a number of people who were able to reach Thailand. And what we found was worrisome situations, not only in terms of how they were, in some cases, forced onto boats by thugs or vigilantes, but also how they were treated on board. The real deprivation that the men, women, and children on these boats faced, you know, the lack of food, the lack of any sort of sanitary accommodation, you know, being stuck below decks for months on end, essentially crammed into these boats like sardines, really shows how heartless and cruel this trade is. You know, it's particularly worrisome that the Thai government is now not permitting the U.S. Navy to help with surveillance, particularly in Thai territorial waters. We've been informed that the Thai government is saying that their 12 nautical mile limit is off limits to any sort of search and rescue craft from the U.S. who are seeking to help try to find the remaining boats. That really raises some fundamental concerns about what the Thai officials might be trying to hide.
Will this tragedy, as horrific as it has been, perhaps be a watershed development for the Rohingya with regard to the improved treatment and attention?
Well, I hope so, but that's going to require a major push from the international community, particularly countries like the United States, members of the European Union, Australia, and others, supporting the frontline states like Thailand, Malaysia, and Indonesia to demand that Burma change its policies. to, you know, end the systematic human rights abuses against the Rohingya people in Arakan State that has left, you know, over 800,000 of them stateless and hanging on for dear life in very difficult situations in Arakan State. The government of Burma is still in denial. They're still claiming that there's no problem. And as I said, they're trying to cast aspersions at the problems here are all about traffickers from outside the country coming in to try to entice people to leave. The Burma government really is showing its repressive tendencies when we look at the issues of the Rohingya. It shows really that the sort of reform process in Burma has not gone half as far as many people think it has.
And Phil Robertson of Human Rights Watch says information that his group has indicates Myanmar security officials have been involved in taking money to allow boats operated by human smugglers to depart. He suspects Bangladeshi officials may also have been involved. Now that Malaysia and Indonesia have pledged to provide a year of shelter to thousands of migrants, Robertson says he hopes Friday's meeting in Bangkok will provide clarity on granting access to them by UN refugee officials who are able to help resettle them in third countries. With the U.S. pledging to take in 1,000 of the refugees, he hopes some will also eventually be allowed to stay on in Indonesia and Malaysia as migrant workers. Well, joining me here in the studio is Web Desk editor Andrew Palshevsky with a look at what's trending. So, Andrew, what's happening?
Well, Sarah, on any given day, sports is usually one of the top trending, if not the top trending,
absolutely,
items in social media. And today it is, again, hashtag FIFA, but for all the wrong reasons. Early this morning, the U.S. Justice Department announced that they were indicting several FIFA officials for corruption charges surrounding the 2018 and 2022 World Cup bids in Russia and Qatar. Their Swiss counterparts made 7 arrests this morning. And so this is a huge trending topic on Twitter. FIFA, obviously, and football or soccer, as we call it here in the U.S., is a huge global sport. Could not come at a worse time for President Sepp Blatter. He is running for his 5th term as FIFA president on Friday, and the hashtag Blatter Out is trending and moving its way up Twitter, with people wanting him to get out and move out of the way because of this rampant corruption that's been going on. We also see cartoons depicting Blatter as Dr. Evil from the movie Austin Powers. We have other cartoons where the World Cup trophy is depicted as two people trying to hide a bag of money. So this is a huge, huge scandal, one that's playing out on social media before our very eyes.
And as you said, it's sort of instant reaction to all of this.
Absolutely. It's kind of been simmering for years. I mean, there have been accusations against FIFA for years and years, but now this is kind of the flashpoint and everyone's jumping on it on social media. Another hashtag that's trending this morning, and it's interesting where it's trending, is hashtag Queen's Speech. Now, Queen Elizabeth in the UK gives a speech at the start of every new parliament to lay out the government's agenda. The interesting thing is this is actually trending in the US as well as in the UK. And part of that is because of the global society we live in now. There's a lot of talk about whether Britain's going to stay in the EU, how that's going to play out, and that has global implications for the US. Obviously, the UK is one of the US's closest allies, so that's why that's trending in the US. And then, of course, there's always Taylor Swift, who's just a consistent trending topic on social media. Trending this morning for two reasons. One, she told the BBC that being a pop star, it's not that hard.
Really?
So I say I'd gladly, you know, trade with her. If she wants to come into VOA, I'll go out there. She did say she works very hard. She goes out and performs every night and gives it her all. So she did kind of walk back those statements a little bit. And another trending story, a teacher in the U.S. state of Montana said that if Taylor Swift will call him, he will cancel final exams for his entire class. More to follow if she actually does make that call.
We'll have to wait and see. Well, thanks very much, Andrew. Web Desk editor Andrew Palshevsky.
This is Science in a Minute. I'm Rick Pantaleo. The World Health Organization says that the rise of antibiotic-resistant infections has become an increasingly serious threat to global public health. Hindering doctors' efforts to quickly treat these potentially life-threatening infections like MRSA and multidrug-resistant tuberculosis is the amount of time it now takes for needed diagnostic tests to come back from the lab. Currently, it can take up to 3 days before a doctor receives the test results. But now a team of researchers from the University of Toronto have developed a small and simple diagnostic chip they say will allow doctors to get completed test results in only 1 hour. Getting these test results faster will allow doctors to quickly select and administer the most effective antibiotic treatment for these specific resistant infections. And that's your Science in a Minute.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. A heat wave in India has left more than 1,000 people dead, and forecasters expect the punishing conditions to persist through the coming days. Most of the deaths have come in the southern states of Andhra Pradesh and Telangana, where the forecasters predict high temperatures will exceed 40 degrees Celsius through at least the end of the month. This is VOA.
Here are the headlines. Football's global governing body, FIFA, was rocked Wednesday by a massive U.S. federal corruption indictment against current and former top officials and the announcement of a separate investigation by Swiss authorities into allegations connected to the awarding of the 2018 and 2012 World Cups. Several FIFA officials have been arrested in Zurich. Top nuclear negotiators from the United States, South Korea, and Japan agreed in a meeting Wednesday that they need to increase pressure and sanctions against North Korea while continuing diplomatic efforts to address the country's nuclear weapons program. The U.S. and South Korean envoys are due to travel to Beijing to meet their Chinese counterpart as they continue working on a unified approach to North Korea. Britain's Queen Elizabeth has made a formal speech before Parliament to lay out the agenda for the Conservative government, including a promise of an in-or-out popular vote on the European Union membership. The Queen appeared before the lawmaking body Wednesday. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
This is International Edition. Coming up, American veterans grieve for their fallen friends. Large areas of Texas and Oklahoma are struggling to recover from flooding brought on by heavy rains that swept over the southern plains Monday and into Tuesday morning. Authorities say at least 18 people died in Texas as a result of the flooding, and some roads remain inaccessible. As VOA's Greg Flakes reports from Houston, more rain is expected in the coming days.
Some of the most heavily traveled roads to the north and south of downtown Houston turned into rivers of dark, muddy water during the torrential downpours. Dozens of automobiles and trucks were abandoned along some highways, and water flowed into the ground floors of houses and some business buildings in low-lying areas. With more rains expected, Houston Mayor Anise Parker says city workers are going into affected areas as soon as they can to see what can be done.
Those areas that are still underwater would be the ones that we'd be most concerned about, but Public Works, and I have the Public Works Director here, Public Works will be out as soon as it's safe to do so to inspect overpasses and bridges.
Parker says that while more rain is expected all through this week, forecasters do not expect anything nearly as big as Monday's storm. While critical roadways were cut off by the floodwaters, Parker noted that most parts of the city came through the big storm well.
Lots of the city was unaffected by last night's torrential rains or this morning's flooding, but the bios have begun to recede. We all have to remember that we're the point of a really big funnel that kind of extends up into central Texas, and a lot of water that falls upstream flows through Houston. It's still a dangerous situation along the bios. They're full of water. The water's moving very, very rapidly.
One thing that helped authorities respond quickly to the storm is a sophisticated early warning system designed in 1997 by Rice University civil engineering professor Phil Bedient.
It's run quite well over the years, but this is a real challenge because of the size of the event.
Bedient says the Flood Alert System 3, also called Phase 3, uses radar, hydrological modeling, and data from a variety of sources to give an 80 to 90% accurate prediction of rainfall in the area around the Texas Medical Center, where some hospitals were flooded during hurricanes in past years. Bedient says the massive storm system that rolled over central and east Texas Monday and Tuesday put the Phase 3 to a real test.
This system that came through yesterday and also the system that hit central Texas, well, on Wimberley and San Marcos, these systems were kind of linked together, and they created just enormous intensities of rainfall. You know, we had a river over there that rose 30 feet in less than an hour, which is just unheard of.
Bedient says the warning system is now being used by police and emergency response agencies, but that he would like to see devices in each emergency vehicle. The Phase 3 is updated every 5 minutes and can be accessed from any computer with an internet connection. He says well-informed citizens are able to protect themselves from flood-related tragedies.
All they needed in some of these river systems was 1 or 2 hours for people to get to high ground so that they don't get killed or they don't lose their vehicles.
This has been one of the rainiest seasons on record in Texas. There have been very few weeks in recent months when it did not rain in the Houston area.
That report by Greg Flakes. Well, this week marked Memorial Day in the United States, a national holiday that Americans traditionally celebrate with a 3-day weekend. But for many military veterans, the holiday was also a time to remember individual fallen comrades they fought alongside. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with a few still grieving veterans outside of Veterans Administration Hospital in New York City.
War and personal loss continue all year long for Russell Edgett as he stands, cane in one hand, cigarette in the other, outside a Manhattan VA hospital. Edgett did 2 tours of duty in Afghanistan over his 12-year Army career and was severely wounded before being discharged. His wartime memories are laced with grief.
I lost 2 friends of mine in my last tour of Afghanistan in 2012, Sergeant Jose Reyes and Daniel Rodriguez. They were very nice sergeants, very family-oriented. Jose Reyes was a young soldier. Before he passed away, he just had a little brand-new baby. And Daniel Rodriguez, he had 4 children.
How did they die?
They died from an IED explosion. They both got killed in the same truck.
Can you tell me like a little story, a little telling detail about one of them, just like somebody that you remember that would only be him, you know?
Jose, I talked to him like on a daily basis and be always willing to help the soldier with something. He just was very nice and very outgoing. Sergeant Rodriguez, he was straightforward. If you did something wrong, he'd get on your case, but at the same time, he'd be the good cop, bad cop in the same shot. He'd yell at you, but then again, 5 minutes later, he'd be joking around with you.
So how do you feel when you remember them? Do you feel sad or happy?
I feel sad because I was very close to both of them.
Not every fallen soldier was a family man or even old enough to be a family man. Sam, an ex-Marine who didn't want the VOA to use his full name, saw more than his share of carnage in Vietnam. He remembers young Don Bullock.
At the age of 14, he joined the Marine Corps. He was killed on a firebase at 15. He stopped being a little boy. He was a man and a Marine. He didn't brag about anything. He wanted to count for something, like everybody else that joined the military. They wanted to be somebody. And we should honor guys like this.
Fellowship and laughter, sometimes grim laughter, can be important parts of a combat soldier's experience. Sinclair Bourne remembers his friend, Lance Corporal Terry Lee Furman. They met between deployments in a Hawaii military hospital after each had been wounded in Vietnam.
I was medevac from Vietnam, being blown up in a tunnel. I'm definitely left here. So he was telling me how he got shot up the first time when he was in Vietnam. And we were laughing at that, about our different wounds and everything. That's hard to believe. People sitting down laughing that they got wounded and crying over our friends that didn't make it. It's just crazy.
Later, during a fierce firefight on Easter Sunday, 1968, Furman was hit again, this time accidentally, by so-called friendly fire from the American side.
And sliced the back of his head off. That went all the way over there, fell in the back of his head, and tied it up.
Soon, a helicopter arrived to take Bourne, Furman, and their surviving comrades away from the battle. But Bourne didn't want to go.
I said, I'm going back out there to fight. They need somebody to fight out there. He died 4 days later.
Do you miss the guy?
Yeah, I missed the guy.
Rocco J. Moretto is a World War II veteran of D-Day. He remembers his friend, Cook, whom he met and befriended while training together in London before the invasion.
Yeah, Cook was a happy-go-lucky kid. We were almost inseparable. He used to say to me, when I get killed, he says, send the wristwatch back to Teresa That was his wife. He had just gotten married. And he wouldn't say if, he'd say when I get killed.
The two survived many bloody battles together. But Moreto says that all changed on September 17th, 1944.
It was a very, very dark night. You couldn't see the guy in front of you. And I was behind him and I was holding his belt. They started shooting the machine guns down the road. And I slowly, he got very, very heavy. I couldn't hold him up. He was the first soldier to be killed that night. And unfortunately, I never was able to get his watch from. The Germans overran us there. I've thought about that my whole life, that I never was able to do that. God knows who wound up with it, you know?
Veterans like these may carry unseen wounds from war that will last their lifetimes. Their grief is not restricted to national holidays or to the memorial statues and monuments that dot America's towns and cities. Yet it also powerfully honors all those who have fought and died in America's wars. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
If you'd like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The governments of the United States and Lao PDR presented a multilateral wildlife trafficking workshop in Vientiane from May 6th to 8th. The workshop included investigators and prosecutors from Indonesia, Lao PDR, Malaysia, Thailand, and Vietnam. Ambassador Daniel A. Clune of the U.S. Embassy in Vientiane and Director General Kamput Pandanuvong of the Lao Department of Forest Inspection opened the workshop on May 6th. In his opening remarks, Ambassador Clune highlighted the importance of the participants' work. Wildlife trafficking is a serious concern, with illicit proceeds estimated at $8 to $10 billion annually. Increasingly, wildlife trafficking is intertwined with other illicit activities that undermine national security and economic prosperity. Combating wildlife trafficking requires collaborative actions and cooperation. The Laos Wildlife Trafficking Workshop is the third in a series of regional wildlife trafficking law enforcement workshops supported by the United States Department of State's Bureau of International Narcotics and Law Enforcement Affairs, or INL. The first workshop was held in Bogor, Indonesia, in May 2014. The second was held in Hanoi in November 2014. The workshops provide an opportunity for officials from participating countries to discuss policy, information sharing, and enforcement issues. Ultimately, the workshop offers participants an opportunity to improve regional cooperation to combat wildlife trafficking and other illicit activities of transnational criminal organizations. These workshops are just one aspect of the strengthened commitment of the United States to support efforts to stop wildlife trafficking and protect endangered species around the world. In July 2013, President Obama signed an executive order that resulted in the first U.S. national strategy for combating wildlife trafficking. The strategy incorporates the efforts of over 17 U.S. government agencies and sets three strategic priorities: strengthening enforcement, reducing demand, and building international cooperation. We're proud to be able to work together with our Lao partners on endeavors such as these, said Noah Gieseman, acting director for the INL section at the U.S. Embassy. The Department of Forest Inspection has been extremely supportive, he said. We hope that all the participants will be able to use this three-day workshop to build a stronger network of partnerships across Southeast Asia, and that our nations can continue to work together against wildlife traffickers and transnational crime.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.